Well, I'm really glad. This is my third time here. I was first here with Dennis O'Morku's book, Religion in Exile, which, of course, has the deep evolutionary theology implicit in it. And then I was here showing my own DVD, and I began to feel such resonance with this group, such affinity with the deep spiritual aspect of evolution combined with the true reality of Catholicism, that I really, like John F. Kennedy said, "Ich bin ein Berliner," I would say, "I am a Catholic." Really Catholic. Really Catholic. And now I'm here for the work of Beatrice Bruteau. And I'd just like to say a word that she is a friend of Sydney and mine. We spent time visiting her, where is it, in North Carolina, I believe. She's a true contemplative. And the book that most excited me originally was God's Ecstasy. Did you read that one? Ah, that's another one to look at. It's like K.R. Desjardins, seeing God in evolution. And she takes a really scientific look at how you could see God in evolution, and she builds a lot on K.R. Desjardins. So she is one of my very favorite writers and people in the world. Now, what you've given me is no small subject, and what Beatrice has undertook, sin and salvation. I read it very carefully, and I took notes on it. I'd like to tell you what I think her key points are, and then take off from there as to how I would apply them from an evolutionary perspective. So the first thing she says in The Mystery of Evil is that punishment doesn't work. Now, that would be a big epiphany. Can you imagine actually getting that punishment doesn't work? Can you imagine the amount of energy our society is spent on punishing? Mm-hmm. Not only the war and the military, but the prisons. When I heard that if Libby gets indicted, he has possibly 30 years in prison? Scooter Libby? I mean, that's just one out of thousands of cases. So punishment doesn't work, nor does meditating on the mystery of evil and why God would have given it to us. So she did not. She just says, let's trace evil to its roots. First, she says, it's not a fundamental archetype. It's not like good and evil. Good is fundamental. Evil is always a reaction to something else. It is less fundamental. It's dependent, not original. And here's the key. Evil comes about when what is perceived as a basic metaphysical need in the agent of evil to stay alive and to maintain one's own identity. Evil comes about when the person who's perpetrating it feels that it's necessary to hurt someone else to maintain their own identity. And the agent of evil identifies identity with what she calls the image self. There are lots of words for this, the egoic self, the personality self. When you identify your reality with that image self, and you believe that that is truly who you are going to defend that egoic self by hurting others who might hurt you. Because if that's your identity, you're bound to try to protect your identity. She calls it also the descriptive self, and she calls it the image self. Make evil acts or sin possible. It's by identifying yourself with all different categories of race, color, occupation, wealth, fame. If your self-esteem is framed in terms of that, and then you're not the top dog or you're deprived of it, you are going to seek compensation either by attaining superiority or putting somebody else down. In other words, evil comes about by the way we structure our values, and even deeper, by our own way we identify ourselves. So as long as we identify ourselves with our egoic self, and somebody threatens us, we're going to react. And that, since for 50,000 years, we have been developing self-consciousness for Homo sapiens. In a way, it's not surprising that we identify with our egoic self. Because up until, unless you're a real mystic, you don't know. So I have, this is me commenting on Beatrice here, there's a certain compassion I feel because our nervous systems are actually designed for us to feel separate, to try to get food when we're hungry, to try to kill somebody who's trying to kill us. So the entire structure of our behavior really comes from that identification of ourselves with that image self, descriptive self, egoic self. And fighting and oppressing are systematic necessities given this current mentality. And that really describes, he says, why is war continuing? Why is violence continuing? Why is greed continuing? What is wrong? What's wrong is the actual mentality that says to us, I am that image self, and I have to be superior to others. And our nervous systems have been structured that way, so when we get really right down to this, this is going to have to deal with the evolution of the person to be able to actually overcome evil. This is not just a superficial thing. And we talk about, we'll get to how she sees it happening. It is so fundamental that I really believe it's going to require a natural evolutionary process. She says that the agent of evil exercises choice freedom, not creative freedom. Choice freedom originates in the environment. If you attack me, I have a choice to attack you back because that came from outside my identity and I'm going to attack back. So if you just think of the world, the amount of choice freedom originating in our environment that's going on is absolutely horrendous. I mean, I just can't help but think of what's happening in Iraq and how people are killing each other. It's originating in their environment in a mentality that identifies the image with a particular identity, whether you're CI or CIA or American, and you're willing to completely violate another person out of that. And we're living in the midst of it in the most horrific way. So choice freedom comes from our environment. Creative freedom is you are the author of your act. Not in reaction, it is self-initiated. So that must mean it's coming from a deeper self. It's not coming from the image self that is in comparison to others. Evil acts, Beatrice says, are all cases of choice freedom. The agent of evil believes if he doesn't act, he will die. And that can be on a very somewhat superficial level. If I don't get the best grades, if I don't get the best relationship, if I don't earn enough, if I'm not good enough, I will die. Because somewhere inside that ego field, it will die. And then you will do almost anything not to die, so it's a survival instinct. Evil is chosen under great pressure to preserve oneself and to shore up that insecure self. So this gives us the possibility of being compassionate on it. Because we understand, and I think Beatrice is very clear on this, it's based on falsehood. No one cares enough about me to preserve my being. Therefore, I don't have to do it. And if anybody dares diminish me in any way, I will have to kill them, because otherwise they will kill me. There's the whole story. sin does not originate in pure freedom. So sin originates from the local self, the descriptive self, the image self, that identifies itself with its own image rather than something deeper. Sin originates in lack of sufficient, believable, unconditional love. Sin originates in lack of believable, unconditional love. Now that's a big one. Because how is it really possible to believe in unconditional love? Not because I'm good, not because I was a good girl, not because I did everything right. What is the source of unconditional love? So she makes the point, it's salvation through love. When you believe that someone else is sustaining you, then all the self-defense operations which result in sins will evaporate. So if I believe that I am being sustained by something other than my egoic need to be superior and to prevail, I have no need to sin. I have no need to hurt anybody because I'm not threatened. And that's, you know, where Jesus is such an incredible example, to be able to walk into that crucifixion without reacting, because he was not threatened. That's a complete shift of identity from the ego itself. It's probably the strongest example in human history that we understand and can see. And look what happened, the resurrection. But that's another story. Salvation comes when this So what needs appeasing is the craving for life of the descriptive self. The craving for life and continuity of that egoic self needs appeasing. So the salvation comes through loving the sinner. And that might mean loving somebody else as the sinner, but I really think it means loving yourself as the sinner. What dies is the ego image self. So in order for us to overcome evil, sin, violence, it would be to be able to identify not with our egoic local personality, but with our essential self. And the central sanctuary is released, she said. And I like that phrase, the central sanctuary is released when you identify with that deep self, that essential self, that divine self, that God self. So what's the central sanctuary? It's infinite safety. It's infinite connectivity with the whole. It's blissful. And you begin to be filled up with something so much greater than what your ego could ever get to, that I always think it's the pleasure principle, basically. It's really better. Because, this is my comment here, whenever the ego is in charge, there is an anxiety. I can tell in my own biofeedback system, when my egoic personality feels threatened by something, there'll be a clench in the solar plexus, there'll be a twinge in the nervous system, and I used to override it in order to try to do what I felt I needed. Now I stop. And you might say I try to go into the central sanctuary. And then to have some compassion on the poor egoic self that has mistaken my identity. That's a mistake that that's my identity, but I sort of have compassion on the egoic self because it really looks that way in the existing world, in the existing system. Okay, We are saved by believing in God's love. Salvific love is not a response to some attractive attributes. God's salvific love is impartial, creative, and not conditional. So what makes it possible to believe that? That's really a big jump, particularly in Western civilization where we've been told we all did something wrong and our father doesn't love us and we're all excluded from the garden. I mean, there's a story in there that makes it very hard to feel that you're not guilty almost all the time, isn't it? And I mean, I'd like a good theological explanation of how we're supposed to overcome that, with that creation story. That somehow seems to hold, even though people don't necessarily believe it, it's embedded in us that somehow we're failing and we have to do better or God will not love us or we will not be lovable. I hardly know anybody that doesn't have that somewhere inside them. So let's say the older religions really told us we were guilty. And even the interpretation of Jesus in some places tells us he has to die for our sins, which doesn't describe it the way Beatrice does, but describes it as we're really bad. And we're bad from the origin. This is a terrible thing. I'm sorry. This is bad. Whoa. All right, so God's salvific love is impartial, creative, and not conditional, and we cannot do anything to deserve God's love. It's grace. It's always there. And when we go into the discussion, I really would like to ask people how you feel that. Given this other overlay of theology, which is we're guilty from the origin, and we actually were only saved because somebody else did something. You know, I feel like a great big cell gets lifted off when you let that one go. Yes? Mm-hmm. We cannot do anything to deserve God's love. It's grace. Here is one way I interpret that and how it occurs to me, coming from a Jewish agnostic, secular, competitive, non-metaphysical business family. Which would be, this is just the opposite of what I was told. From that perspective, you see, that you have to get out there and win. And don't be too smart, you won't get a good husband. So, see, I lost my point. How did I get to this? Now, I'll get to myself later. I'm going to go through Beatrice because I want to get the full, beautiful continuity of her. So she says, the egoic self cannot love its enemy because its entire value system is to be superior and to destroy anybody who is inferior. Only the self realized as transcendent to the ego can love the enemies of those descriptions. So that means in order to be able to love your enemy as yourself, you would have to have identified yourself as that transcendent God self. You cannot do it through your ego itself. To tell people to love their enemies, to convince them they are more than what the enemy attacks, it will never work unless first, people must be saved, convinced they are unconditionally loved by God, if you feel loved by that presence unconditionally, you can love others. But if you don't feel that unconditional internal love, you don't have the ability to love others unconditionally with your local, egoic, separated, descriptive self. When we offer people unconditional love, the only way we can do it is through accepting God's unconditional love for ourselves. The mystery of divine love, an original, created, unconditional love directed to us as our transcendent selves, is the way to overcome what's called evil. I'm going to say that again. That's straight from Beatrice. The mystery of divine love, an original, creative, unconditional love directed to us as our own transcendent self. When you accept that internally as your own identity, not because you're good or better than someone, but because God, Source, Creator, loves unconditionally all of the creation, and you are that in person. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that easy to do?
No.
If it were, we would all have done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we've certainly heard about it. And it certainly feels better. And in high moments of grace, yes, we can do it. But our entire social structure is designed otherwise. In all its forms, academic, religious, political, corporate. And here we are, pioneering souls in the midst of a structure that denies this, with the charge of doing it for ourselves first. That's really what she's saying. If you don't do it by internalizing within yourself the unconditional love of the divine, you will not be a true change agent in your family, in your community, or in your world. So this puts the spiritual shift at the very core of the change of the world. We can have wonderful social changes like we had democracy. It's certainly a lot better than monarchy or totalitarianism. But you see what happens, it gets corrupted every time. Because whatever the system, the organized church has these beautiful basic reality underlying it, but the human beings running it have not been able to make this shift. And what would, there are several ways of looking at this, but I'd like to take just an evolutionary take on it first, and then a personal. This is where my hope comes from, because quite often people say to me, Barbara, you are really idealistic. In other words, stupid. In the world would make you believe that we could change human nature. Human nature is fixed. This is the way it's always been. And if you read A Terrible Love of War, you'll see we've been killing each other ever since we got to chance. And you, idealistic, silly person, are believing that we can transform. What in the world are you thinking of? So this is where I draw on dear old Teilhard de Chardin. I said, well, about 100,000 years ago, Homo sapiens wasn't here. And about, 2 million years ago, 6 million years ago, there were no humans at all. And even, 500 million years ago, there was barely any mammalian life. And 3.5 billion years ago, there was no life at all. So don't tell me things haven't changed. In other words, if you want to deny change, you can do it if you have a very short historical time frame. But if you stand up and you allow yourself to witness the entire process of God's creation over those billions of years, and you see the enormity of change, and then this is through Teilhard de Chardin, as well as Beatrice in God's Ecstasy, if you see that every time there was a major jump, like from pre-life to life or animal to human, there was a jump in consciousness and freedom to choose. It doesn't mean to choose right, but freedom to choose, to act through more complex synergistic order. So there is, if you want to take God as the evolving aspect of creation, not only God the eternal, but God the evolving creative force that brought us from subatomic particles to us here, at the threshold of self-destruction or self-evolution through our power. My faith is that this very thought is the intention of creation for us to shift our identity from our egoic, separated selves that now have the powers of God, to shift that identity from the self-conscious Homo sapiens to the spirit-centered, God-centered, whole organism, consciousness, humans, and that this is as natural a phenomenon as the shift from Neanderthal to Homo sapiens. In other words, there is no reason to assume that the evolutionary process of creation, if we particularly see it as a divine expression, would stop here with this incomplete species, with the powers that could lead to cooperation with the divine or destruction. If you see it this way, you begin to get a huge amount of support inside yourself for that in you that is shifting from your egoic personality self to your essential and divine self. And you realize you are part of the evolution of our species. Because it's my conviction that if our species is not evolving in this direction of shifting identity from the separated self to the divine self, we will not be here for very long. Because the God-given brain has created the understanding of atoms, genes, brains, and we can blow up worlds. And maybe the whole pattern of that evil has finally come to the crisis of the absolute end of the dominion of the ego if the human species is to survive. Because the ego collectively, Alan Lipman calls it egoic mutants. We've been egoic for some time. But egoic mutations is when collective ego has powers of nuclear, biotech, nanotech, computing, missiles in space. We have reached egoic mutations, where the collective egoic capacity has literally the capacity to destroy the whole system. So it appears to me that this beautiful theology that's embedded in our story here is being favored, pressed forward by the survival instincts themselves. Because in order to survive, the human species cannot remain in its collective ego state. And you can begin to see it as the peace movements rise. As the Department of Peace in Washington meeting evidently was a huge success, Dennis Kucinich has proposed the Department of Peace. It has like 1/100th of the budget of the Department of Defense. And they think that's radical. But you know what? Here's what's really happening. The biggest mass movement in the history of humanity is now occurring, and it's under the radar of the mass media and the mass politics. It may be in the minds of some of our politicians, but they don't know how to say it. Because you know what? They're going to appear weak if they talk like this. This is the greatest strength there is. So anyway, I believe that the force of creation, the God force, that has been evolving an entire universe, has created the intelligent species on this planet with the freedom to destroy itself or evolve itself through identification with the source of creation as our own being. We're being forced towards divinity. And if that's the goal, that we should be in the image of God, if we should be co-creators with the divine, if that's the goal, it appears to me that the powers of the collective ego will become and are already so threatening that the rise of the divine human potential movement is happening in our midst. That's the new phrase for it. We've had the human potential movement. This is the divine human potential movement. And almost all of us look insignificant. We do not look like we're the head of anything. Because the head of anything wouldn't dare say this and they'd lose their job. Yeah. But that's not to say that they might not feel this way. I mean, I have friends who know Hillary Clinton very well. They said she is an entirely different person when you met her personally than what she has to present herself. She thinks she has to present herself in order to win with the egoic mentality of this country. Yeah. Obama seems to be just being able, maybe just a little bit, to say, he calls himself post-partisan. Wow. So I want to just conclude by saying, this is the way I realized it one day when I was in my usual self-judgment mode. See, self-judgment is really the basis of it. Then you identify with your ego, and basically you feel less than somebody else. And you probably never, you know, rather than go out and kill them, you're feeling serious. I mean, it's more likely in people like us, not that we go out and kill them once, but we're just feeling inferior, therefore we don't realize our potential. Because if you feel inferior, you won't realize your potential. So I got this message that don't I realize that I didn't create myself, God created me. So if I am self-judging myself as inadequate, I am obviously judging God. Because I did not create this person. And if my egoic self judges this person as inferior, I have judged God's creation as inferior. And I really got that that is wrong. And then I thought about Jesus, the whole amazing thing about you are my son in whom I am very well pleased. Isn't that the symbol of that blessing coming down unconditionally for all of us? You are my son, you are my daughter, in whom I am very well pleased. And then he went for the 40 days in the wilderness. And I believe those 40 days were shifting identity from the egoic self. Satan gets the head. I won't just seek power for power's sake. To identify only the Word of God. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you've seen you, you've seen the Father. See, but the Christian church, if I may say, makes it hard for you to say that. Yes, it is what he told us. Where's that wonderful priest? Is he here? The one that was here last time?
No,
what was his name?
Father Ludo.
Father Ludo. All right, so if you have seen me and seen you, you've seen the Father and I are one. See, Jesus, the whole story, this is, you are my son in whom I'm very well pleased. So then you're able to say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The Father and I are one. And in my language, I'm calling this the birth of a universal human. And I believe the universal human is one of many descriptions of the kind of human that's been gestating for thousands of years in all the great faiths and traditions, but that is being born now by the nature of the crises we're facing, which is the collective ego will destroy us. it means that that I have discovered that my ego cannot stand being separate from my essence any longer. Because it's so painful. And that this is, I don't know where the theology of this comes in, but I believe that when you grasp this identity, and when you feel the pain of the separated ego, I've experienced in myself what I call the evolution of the ego. In that the ego yearns for union with the internal aspect of the divine. The ego yearns for the possibility of being one with the source of its own being.
Thank you.
The ego feels a sense of internal bliss when it releases its grip of separation and joins you. And I call this the shift from ego to essence. And it's in my book, Emergence. When the ego asks essence to come in the whole way, we've shifted from we have to kill the ego to the ego has matured enough to yearn for oneness with its own aspect of the divine. And everybody's essence is unique, but connected to the one. And I've experienced in this emergence process a gradual shift of my own identity from my egoic self seeking the divine to the internal invention of the divine educating my local self. Because you don't suddenly become a perfected being. But if your identity shifts to the essential self, then when you have an egoic episode of separation, of fear, of reaction, of jealousy, you have compassion on it. You know you're not that. You hold steady with that essential self and you bring it into your heart. It's exactly what Beatrice is saying. You bring your own local egoic self into your divine heart. And Mother, Father, God comes home, internalized, as you. And, of course, as anybody else who's doing the same. And so in this process, it's very necessary to have small groups of people who are willing to undertake this, because when you see the other as that, and the other sees you as that, you develop a field of resonance, resounding, echoing back, and in echoing back from the other to yourself, because you're seeing the other sees you as that, and you see the other as that, you create what I consider a standing wave inside yourself so you can remember. And I think we're all very newborn, universal humans. We're not yet able to remember it all the time. But if we live in a community of souls that are remembering it and we join together just like this, we will find that the force of creation that created us from nothing at all is exactly the force that's evolving us to become universal co-creators, restoring the earth, freeing ourselves from poverty and disease, and exploring the vast regions of the human spirit and the universe beyond our home planet. Thank you.
Box up here. So we'll take a break, have a little refreshment, and then come back for some interactive conversation.